I'm not super worried about like, how do I scale? I'm more worried about how do I get to the point where we can scale.
Herzlich willkommen zu meinem Podcast Punkt Genau. Heute die 58. Ausgabe. Mein Name ist Semir Fazadi, Ihr Scrum Master und Interim Manager für Finanzen, Rechnungswesen und Controlling. Eine Anmerkung in eigener Sache, bevor die Show losgeht. Wenn Ihnen der Podcast gefällt, dann hinterlassen Sie mir doch ein Abo oder schreiben Sie eine positive Rezension auf den üblichen Plattformen. Das hilft dem Podcast und auch mir, um weiterhin an der Qualität dieses Podcasts zu arbeiten. Aber nun zu unserem Gast. Unser Gast ist eine Amerikanerin. Dieser Gast spricht demzufolge nur Englisch. Also muss ich mich heute zum ersten Mal in englischer Sprache unterhalten. Deswegen auch das Intro jetzt mit deinem Wechsel in die englische Sprache. Welcome to my podcast show, Punkt Genau. This is Semir Fazadi speaking. And today we have our 58th show, and we have a special guest from the United States of America. She is a so-called bootstrapping founder. She shares today her journey to nomadic entrepreneurship. She also discusses with me how she founded her actual company called eWebinar. She will talk about her deeps and her highs of her entrepreneur journey. She will also figure out how hard it is to travel around the world and make things successfully. I'm very happy and I appreciate that really to have you here. Welcome, Melissa Kwon. Nice to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm actually now working on my third company. So I had two companies before this. But yes, my last one, my second one was the one that was acquired. And I'm working on a new one right now.
It is usually here in the show, we have in the beginning a little bit sentences to fulfill. And so I have already something prepared for you. And first of all, I was born in as a child of.
Oh, are you looking for like a place?
Yes, or of just course. Anything? Yes, where have you born?
Yeah, I was born in the U.S. I wasn't sure if that was like a creative question. I was expecting a harder question, but yes, I was born in the U.S.
Okay. And you were grown up as child of a, what was your parents' profession?
My mom was a housewife. She never really had a career. She just took care of us. And my dad... he was a purchaser of the Hong Kong Jockey Club, which is actually, it's a nonprofit, but it's actually the largest single taxpayer in Hong Kong because of how big that organization is. And he just started kind of as an office boy. And then, you know, I think he spent 35 years or something at the same company and eventually made it to the head of purchasing.
Okay. This sentence, my mom is worrying when she hears about another move in my life because.
Sorry, can you repeat that? My mom is
worrying when she hears worrying. About that I'm moving again.
I don't even think my mom knows where I am half the time. Yeah. She actually has very little... she has very little awareness of my location.
Oh, great. And your life as a teenager was impressed by?
Wow, that's a hard one. My life as a teenager, I was most impressed by freedom. Oh. I guess that's no different than right now. I hated being a kid. I hated being... under my parents' roof and not being able to do things on my own. And, you know, my dad was pretty strict. So I couldn't go out until I was pretty old on my own. And there was just a lot of rules in my house. So I just wanted to be alone and be free.
Okay, thank you. I have two other sentences prepared a little bit. My worst subject during school was...
physics.
But like me, I hate that subject, really. And the first thing that I had when in school during the school time here in Germany, you have the possibility to make a, how say, to leave a hit behind you and to take another one. But physics is something that is so far away from my imagination. I don't know. It's probably the same as you. And being lazy means to me.
Wow. Okay. Being lazy means to me not executing on the thing that you say you're going to execute on.
Okay, great. And now, last sentence, and then we can go into deep dive your business life. Life as an entrepreneur is thrilling because
you never know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Great, great. Thanks for the first part of our show. And now we are going deep dive into your business and your experiences, your ahas, and your lessons learned and whatever you have learned and being comforted with in life. And first of all, the working life has changed. Everything is talking about remote work and working from islands next to businesses here in Germany, in Europe, or in the US. And a lot of people are moving around and traveling around and making their work from over there. And this is most probably influenced by the Corona pandemic, but at least we have a lot of digital nomads here, Melissa. And now you are staying in Bangkok. Why Bangkok?
Bangkok is warm. And I'm a big city person. Like, I used to live in New York for 3 years and we always miss New York. But it just got way too expensive. Went back a couple of years ago and it was just unaffordable. And so last year we came to Bangkok. We always spend winters in somewhere in Asia just because it's warm. And we felt like Bangkok was the New York of Asia. It's very vibrant, very big, really high quality things for relatively cheap. I mean, this year I came back and I really feel like things, like I could feel things got more expensive, but I think relative to the rest of the world, it's still cheap for what you're getting. And you know, like I was, you know, we spent a few years in Amsterdam and we're just looking for a new adventure. And this felt right.
Yeah, leads me to my next question, because you have said, give me the word into that question, adventure. When you are a digital nomad, isn't it a little bit an adventure in every city, comparing New York, Amsterdam, and now Bangkok? You are doing this traveling around and working and founding new companies since a while, but in comparison to the past, let's look a little bit back to 10 years ago. What changed in the feeling next to the thing that things getting a little bit expensive?
What do you mean? What do you mean by what changed?
The atmosphere, the possibilities to set up a network, to getting started in a town, in an infrastructure. Is there a difference next to the price development on one side for having a satisfactionable life? Is it in comparison for 10 years ago for you a little bit like, hey, 10 years ago it was easier to come to a new town, to Amsterdam, to set up all the things that you need for getting starting a business, to nowadays 2023?
Yeah, I mean, I think things are exponentially easier, right? Like if you're talking like compared to 10 years ago, I guess 10 years ago I was still living in Vancouver. 10 years ago, my life was very different. I thought my life was going to be like normal white picket fence. I was going to date someone, get married, have kids, and do the whole thing. When I was 32, I moved to New York and then I never really stopped traveling. But since then, you know, not only did Airbnb come up, right? Like Airbnb, I think, really changed everything. It allowed you to rent anything anywhere in the world for lower than hotel prices, but for a longer time. And you have a real home and a kitchen and all that, right? So you can stay for longer. But also the gig economy happened, right? So people becoming their own boss, right? And then realizing way before the pandemic that they can be a freelancer on the go. And so I think in the past 5 years, that community has really grown. And then there became platforms and communities where these people kind of congregate, right? So Nomadlist, for example, or multiple Facebook groups, like every single city you go to, if you type it into Facebook, there will be an expat group. And if you really wanted to meet people, that's where you can start. Or, you know, as you get older and you meet more people like yourself that like this lifestyle, everyone has friends that are in different places. So it's definitely become a lot easier, specifically for myself, because I have a lot of people in my own community that do exactly this. So not only did like lodging and like getting a place get easier, also just it's more widely accepted, I think, as a just not even as a founder anymore, right? Like I think right now, if you're a company and you don't have at least a part-time remote policy, it's going to be very hard for you to retain really good talent. And that really happened after the pandemic. So it's just normal, I think, right now, especially for like people that are around my age, right? So people that have been working for more than 10 years, a little bit more senior, right? Like this might not work if you're in a big company with many people and you're junior, because you need to be there, learn from people, learn by osmosis, learn what other people are doing, and learn structure and teamwork. And a lot of times, you can't do that on your own. So actually, a few times we've tried to hire people because our team is fully remote. We've tried to hire junior people. And while I think the premise, the idea of the lifestyle is very attractive to them, they never really last very long. Because I think it's not even that there's like a culture fit. I think like they just can't pick things up as a solo person unless you are super highly motivated, you research everything, you ask a lot of questions. And I think typically a junior person is not really designed, you know, to do that yet.
Yeah, thanks for the insight. It leads me to another question that is not prepared, but it came from, get an idea, because do you think that it has something to do with the self-motivation, self-leadership or something like that, that as a junior, when I look back into my first steps into the business, into being employed in a company, in a huge company, I was not that structured like today. Yeah? And when I hear that, do you think that this, that even if things, a lot of things changed, also the mindset of this, that kind of people that are now starting into the business with the age of, for example, 25, there are a lot of different to me as in an age for as 25, but is it at least also a question of self-leadership that is still a part of life that you are still learning with the experience and so on? What is your opinion on that?
Well, I think like when you're younger, and I can only really speak for myself. When I was younger, there are different things that motivated me, right? Like going to the office and learning from my managers and my boss and my peers and like listening to other people sell behind me. Like I was always in sales. So like listening to other people and discussing strategies and how do you do this? How do you handle this objection? Like I loved that stuff, right? Because all that was new. I just came out of school and all that was really exciting. And I think the learning component of that really, really drove me, but also kind of the social environment. Because when you just come out of school, all of a sudden you're not with people every day, right? So I think work kind of replaced that. But I think as I got older, and of course, as people started living on the internet a bit more, as it became easier to, I guess, meet internet friends that you can chat with on Slack, you can chat with on Messenger anytime you want, that social aspect changed, right? Like I now have, I would say at my fingertips, a group of at least 30, you know, founders, peers that I can text at any time. And a lot of these people I've never met and I will never meet in real life, but I still feel like they're my friend, right? Like, and maybe we've chatted on Zoom a couple times or maybe not, but I really feel connected to them as if I know them in real life because we are connected through other things and other topics, right? So I think as you, when you're younger in your career to, you know, when you're more experienced, there are just different things that are important to you. And right now what's important to me is I get to live the life that I want. I can go to any wedding, any birthday, take any days off without asking anybody, right? I can hop on a plane anytime and I don't need permission, right? And everybody's remote as well. And we work on every time zone and we only have one team meeting a week between, you know, the four most senior people in the company to make sure everyone's on the same page and that's it. So I think it's just priorities changing and different things that are important to you.
Yeah. And there's something important in that because it gets to my mind now. Now we have the discussion, all the people have to come back to the office and it is must have that you have to stay there over there 3 days a week from five. Three from five. You have to be in the office to have the social connection to the people. And when I'm listening very carefully to your words, you are building up trustees and trust to that people and your own employees also. And on another way, here they are trying to make 12 o'clock lunches with the employees on the remote base or something like that. And you are laughing. And that is a nice try probably. But I think it is it's another way of communication all the time during the time about Slack or whatever, but certain groups and interests. It's another kind of trust, I think. And the people here thinking of, during Corona pandemic, it was a must have to be on a remote. Now they are trying to get the people into the office because they are assuming that the return on invest or the EBIT is not that matter that they are wishing. And you are an example where it works, huh? Okay, but one question, one sentence that you have made in the past, and leads me also into that founding your companies. You have said that you are very thankful to bootstrapping, and you can in that matter you can focus on your satisfaction instead of maximizing profits. That first of all, bootstrapping. What is bootstrapping? Perhaps you can explain for the guests of our show what kind of.
Yeah, so bootstrapping, I mean, as opposed to raising VC capital, is a method of building or funding your company without any venture capital or institutional capital, including growth capital. So it's fully funded by founders, customer revenue, which is, of course, always the best form of funding. And sometimes friends and family, and sometimes angel investors, but no VC-backed funds, which means also like no venture scale return. So nobody's telling you that you have to sell for $1 billion before you return their fund.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this kind of idea, where did this come from? Did you have a book about that? Or what was the motivation to do that in that way?
In my second company, we were doing very poorly for a long time. We couldn't find a product that people would pay for, and we tried to change it over and over. And, you know, because of that, I got into a lot of debt because it just took a long time and I was still paying other people and I took out bank loans. I mean, I think it's a familiar founder story for someone that, you know, doesn't want to give up and want to keep going. And I moved to New York and everybody was raising money and I wanted to raise money. Because I had no money. So I had all this introduction to investors. And the problem was I was pitching and pitching, but nobody would give me money. And the reason why nobody would give me money, I think number one was like I wasn't doing a good job pitching because I didn't actually want the money. I just wanted to not be in debt, right? But number two, like the idea that I had in my previous company wasn't very good. So realistically, I was never going to get funded anyway, even if my pitch was good. And so I still had to keep the company alive and pay my team. So we ended up we did find the product that somebody would pay for, and we closed more and more deals. And I just got to profitability faster. So I realized when you get to profitability, the stress of feeling like you're drowning, right? The stress of like the financial stress and the, you know, feeling like you're always treading water is over. Like now you have a forever company, right? If your company is completely funded by customer revenue and it's covering the cost every month, you have a forever company. And I was there. So I guess I saw both sides of the coin, from the stress of raising VCs and having them say no over and over and what that does to you and your ego, but also living through lying to them and lying to myself that this is the billion-dollar company I want to build. Because I knew that that wasn't a billion-dollar company, but I had to say what they wanted to what they wanted to hear to get the money. So now I'm lying to them and lying to myself, right? And it just wasn't authentic. And so at the same time, because I was in New York, I knew a lot of venture-backed founders, and I saw the stress that they had after they took money. Because after you take the money, they get you to spend the money, but your revenue doesn't catch up. So what happens in 1 or 2 years? You have to raise the other round, the other round, the other round. So as a CEO, like your job is to actually just raise money and not so much to build the business, which, you know, I thought was the job of the CEO. So I just saw both sides, and I saw my friends getting more and more stressed as they were raising more and more. But on the outside, the media made them feel like they were super successful, because every time there was a round, like somebody would write about it, and nobody would write about me, but because I was profitable, I was stress-free. And because of that, I was able to leave New York and travel full-time and do the things that I really always wanted to do. So it wasn't like I knew, oh, I'm going to bootstrap. Like I did it because nobody would give me money and I was forced into that position. But I'm glad I was forced into that position, because I would not live my life any other way right now. Like I can change my company product tomorrow. I can shut it down tomorrow, right? Nobody can tell me I can't do that. I can make any hire I want. I can fire anyone I want. I can have a remote team and have no employees, right? I don't have to have a physical office. And those things are not going to be possible if you had somebody on your board, or if you have, you know, VC money to return.
Okay. Yeah. And I read in one of the articles, you had one moment when your notebook crashed and you had no money on your accounts and the bank. Is it? Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was, I just wrote about my darkest entrepreneur moment. I think every founder has one of those. Like there's like, you know, like your entrepreneur journey is a series of bad moments, but I feel like sometimes it's like a bad day or whatnot, but you have this one thing where you just feel like you are at the lowest point of that pit.
Yeah.
And that was my moment where, you know, I was in my previous company and we couldn't find that product people would pay for. We knew it was going to be a check-in product for real estate. So in the US, when you walk into a house that's for sale, you like write your name on a piece of paper to register. We were the iPad version. That was the end product that people would pay for. So we always knew we were going to be the open house product. We just didn't know like what is that thing? What is that thing that it will do in the open house? And for 2.5 years, we could not find a thing that somebody would pay for. And I remember I was like going to startup events for food, and I would time my meal. I would have one massive salad from this place called Sweet Green at 4:30. So that was the optimal time to eat so that I wouldn't be like too hungry at night. And I did that for 1.5 years, and I would not have more than $100 in my account because I wanted to make sure that we had enough to pay other people. And so I was also taking side projects, trying to get government grants, trying to get tax back from anywhere we can find, apply for any loan, any program, just to make the next payroll. And that, like, I think that also not just like a mental exhaustion, I think your confidence also as a founder takes a really big hit, because then you start to question yourself, like, what am I doing this for? And maybe I'm not meant to succeed, or maybe I should shut this down. Like, because if it's going to go somewhere, maybe somebody would actually pay me for it. And I remember during that time, my laptop had just shut down a couple times, and it was just old. Right? It was like one of those cheaper models, like Apple laptops. And every time it shuts down, I would be nervous because I didn't have money to. All my cards were maxed out. I didn't pay them for years, and like I was just running on this $100 cash. And if there was enough at the end of the month, I would give myself what's left in the account and then pay my rent. So I was just like kind of always patching holes. And the technician said, the next time the laptop shuts down, it's just not worth fixing. Like it's just old and it's just too expensive. And I could barely pay for the actual fix, right? Anytime you bring it in, it's like $300. So I remember being at my co-working space, and I was like, at that point in my life, I was calling anybody who would pick up my phone. I would email anyone, like a prospect customer, anyone that I could find the email of, connect with anyone on LinkedIn. And I remember like it just shut down again. And I'm staring at this black screen, and I just cried. Like in that moment, and I'm not someone who's emotional. I was not so much feeling sorry for myself as it was in that moment. I thought, man, like this just feels so hard. And it's just felt so hard for so long. And I just need a break. Like just throw me something. Like life has to just give me something. And, you know, I felt sorry for myself for maybe an hour or something. And then I went home, and I remembered I had one emergency credit card, and I knew I didn't want to use it because I just wasn't going to pay it back. And I think it had like maybe $1,500 limit on it or something. It was like a really, really low, like cheap level credit card. And I went to Best Buy and I bought a laptop for like $1,300. And of course, I didn't pay that for a while as well. And actually, all those debts were not fully paid until that company was acquired. So, I mean, we still like, you know, at some point we were still like making the interest and stuff. But at some point, like I wasn't paying my credit card. I wasn't paying myself. I wasn't paying the bank. Like I had told them that I wasn't going to be able to pay. So then, of course, the managers don't want you to be in the bad place. So they try to negotiate that maybe they'll lower the interest, and then maybe you only pay the interest for, you know, 16 months or something like that. Like I was getting super creative. I wasn't paying my accountants and I was not paying my lawyer. So, and these are people that kept my company going. And luckily, you know, these kind of services are not things that I would find, you know, a very like cheap person for. So actually we had a good accounting firm. We had a good law firm, and they were big enough to understand my situation and not have to chase me for the bill. And actually, like what I owed them was not small. Like I owed my law firm $45,000, right? My accounting firm, like I didn't pay them for something like 3 years. So then I owe them like $9,000. So it's just debt everywhere. So in that moment, you're just like, oh, now it's my computer. And while that thing seems small, just everything just kind of emotionally came crashing down. But glad I had that moment. Glad it's over, and definitely will try my hardest to not get back there again.
And now you have started eWebinar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell me or our listeners a little bit about what is eWebinar? What is your goal? And now how is this feeling with the same sense of value, same person, well, a little bit older now, a little bit of experience, and now how did you start that?
Yeah, so eWebinar, I started 2 months after my last company was acquired. I sold it for like not retirement money. I sold it for definitely life-changing money, especially having no money for almost 10 years before that. So in that sense, it was definitely life-changing. But I knew I wasn't able to retire on that. And I didn't want to work forever. And that was the urgency. That's why I did it, you know, 2 months after. Like people are like, oh, you started it because you love founding companies and entrepreneurship. It's like, no, I would retire if I can today, but I can't. So eWebinar, we automate webinars, right? So we turn any video into a webinar that you can set on a recurring schedule or make available on demand. So you can do hundreds of demos, training, onboarding webinars every single month without actually being in front of a camera live. And people can ask you questions through chat. You can answer on your phone or answer later by email if, you know, if they're offline, when you, you know, when you see the message. And then you can program in what we call interaction. So polls, questions, hot buttons, you know, so it makes the experience more like interactive TV and less like, you know, a Zoom webinar. But the fact that it's not live means that the quality is much higher, the content is tighter, shorter, and you can just watch it anytime you want. So for any companies that are serving customers or team members anywhere in the world, you're running trainings, demos, and all that stuff 24/7. So that's what we do. This solves a problem that I lived with in my last company. Because we were bootstrapped, we were so small, I was everything except for code. I was the only non-coder on the team. So I was sales, customer success, you know, all that stuff. So I did all those webinars to make sure after somebody buys our product that their employees would use it. Because when someone signs a contract with you, especially when you're selling enterprise SaaS, that's the first day of the rest of your life with them. And if their employees don't use your product, they're not going to renew. So that's why these trainings are so important, but they were always exactly the same. Because I was selling the same product to multiple different companies. But the problem was not only was the presentation the same, people would sign up and then they wouldn't show up. So then sometimes I'm doing it to a room of two people, sometimes one person. And sometimes halfway through, the one person would leave and then I still have to do it because I want the replay. So it just never made sense to me why I have to go and do something that I did yesterday and why the people who couldn't make it couldn't get the same experience or better. Right. So this was just something I thought about a lot. And also at that point, I was already traveling. So not only was I doing these repetitive webinars all the time, I was doing them on opposite time zones. Like 4 p.m. in the US and Japan would be like 4 a.m. So I would do them at 4 a.m. And so after my company was acquired, this was just the problem that kept coming back to me. And I always searched the internet for something that would solve this because I wanted to use it. But there was just nothing that was built and designed the way that I want. Like there were like little software out there, but like I felt like they were designed to like trick people into thinking it's live when it's not, but I don't want to trick people. I want to deliver a beautiful, interactive, like Netflix of webinars where people can just attend anytime they want and have an incredible experience without giving up the one-on-one chat that makes webinars valuable. So I wrote the first check into the company, of course. My co-founder did too. David, he's my CTO and my co-founder, but also my life partner. And we had some funding from friends and family in the beginning to get it started. And I would say definitely it's a lot easier without just the desperation of not being able to pay the team and not being able to pay yourself. But I think the hard is different. Right? Like you're still building a company. It's still brand new. Customer expectations are really high. You still have to figure out how to get it out there, right? Like, and our product starts at $100. So how many $100 do you need to make up for $1 million, right? A lot. So it's just a different, yeah, it's just a different thing I've never done before. Because previously my company was selling like enterprise SaaS. So any product would be 10,000 to 100,000 a year. In fact, when we sold our previous company, we only had 100 customers. And I felt more in control of the sales cycle because I was talking to everybody. And now with a $100 product, it's product-led, it's marketing-led, it's customer-led, other people have to refer, you know? So it's just all this new marketing things that we've never done before. Not a single person on my team, including myself, has a background in marketing. So we had to learn SEO, writing content, social selling, backlinking, like all that stuff we had to learn. So I would say it's a much more difficult company to build, but because I knew exactly what I was building and I knew there was a market for it, it was the time to market was a lot faster. And because I had, you know, because I sold my previous company, I was able to not pay myself for so many years. Like, so we started this company about 4 years ago. I only started paying myself 3 months ago. So that's just how long it takes because there's always another expense, another person you have to hire. People want to get paid more. You know, the company grows and then you need new expertise. So then you push yourself down the totem pole again. So the problem solving just never stops.
Okay, and here you have the idea that you created the market and then you you are creating the market because you have the product for that market and you have to create them. And I think it's not vice versa, because some people, first of all, create a product and then where can I sell it? Where is the market? And you found the market first, I think, is it? That you found, there's a need for it out of the lesson learned of your first company. And this is amazing because a lot of businesses are just working on and on and on, and then the time is going by, and then until the death, something like that, because there's no innovation and no lessons learned out of their own product. And the first, what I realize is that you have found a new idea out of your lessons learned, is it, from the first company, and now you have to get into the market with a lot of new marketing possibilities.
I mean, I didn't dream up something new, right? Like, similar products existed. They just didn't serve the market that I want to sell to. So similar products existed, but they only were really marketed to like solo entrepreneurs, individual marketers, consultants, to like sell a course or, you know, to sell product, to sell an item. And I wanted a product that was sold to small, medium companies, small to medium enterprises, tech companies. Like, I wanted real companies, not a single solo entrepreneur, to be using this, right? I wanted people to be using this in like training and like, you know, training and onboarding, not just using this to, you know, do a demo. So it was what I call purple ocean. Is I took an existing business model that I know works. Like, other companies have been successful in this space doing similar things. But I wanted to apply it to a different consumer, like kind of vertical that was not yet served. And because of that, I knew there was an existing market. And that's why I didn't need to talk to any customers. I didn't do a single customer research, a single customer conversation. But also, I am that customer. I know that pain so well. And I know, through my 10 years of being in startups, I know a lot of other startup vendors that sell to businesses. We talk about this problem all the time. And, you know, maybe you're a huge company and you have a support team of 100 and all these people are running these trainings for you, or you have a really small team and you try to come up with a makeshift solution. So maybe you have a video on YouTube, or you have a video on Intercom, your knowledge base, but people don't like that. They like going to a webinar where they feel like, you know, it's a more interactive experience. So I didn't so much find the market myself. I just knew one existed, but the difficulty of introducing it to someone who's never heard of it before is still there. And that's actually the biggest obstacle that we have now.
Okay. I'm always in examples. For example, I know a huge company, and the onboarding procedures are always, they have to find a date, and then they have to collect all the people from all the plants to one place, and then they are traveling by plane or buses or whatever to that meeting. Now, in reality, with your solution, I assume that everybody in the plant, even if it is 500, 600 kilometers or miles distance to the headquarters, all with your solution, everybody is onboarded on the same way. Probably. Yep. And at any time.
Absolutely.
For example. Yeah. Or I know a lot of people are sitting in the company's compliance. Once a year, you have to be set up in compliance procedures. So with your solution, you can do that all the time, at any time, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, like, anytime you go to a website, you know, you can just click on a demo and hop in right away. You don't have to pick a calendar, fill in a form. Like, I mean, it's just super annoying, right? Like, nobody wants to make that, like, everyone's time is precious right now, right? Everybody lives on their own timeline. I don't get up until 12, and now I'm in Bangkok. So maybe you're going to do that demo or that onboarding session at 11 a.m. Tuesday in Germany. So I'm not going to make it, but, you know, maybe I'll watch the replay. But nobody actually watches the replay. And I think that's why, like, everyone being busy and people not really wanting to join a live call is why traditionally live webinar attendance rates are very low, right? They're about like 20 to 30%. The average attendance rate to our webinars that are completely automated is 65%. So anyone who, you know, has run a webinar before will know that is exceptionally high. But the beauty of it is, even if you miss that and you say, oh, I sign up for the next session, or I just watch the replay, the experience is exactly the same. Right now, when you miss a webinar, you get emailed like a, you know, just a video, right? And then in the video, there's all this stuff that you don't care about. You know, people are being interrupted and they're asking questions and you're, you know, you and then you just kind of bounce, right? But with a webinar, it doesn't matter if you watch it today, tomorrow, next week, you watch a replay, the experience is exactly the same. And that makes the quality, you know, really high.
If somebody is now getting on your team as a team member, first of all, how do you find this kind of people? Because I think they have to be on the same mindset as you have. And absolutely, how do you do that? Is there something special that is in comparison to if you are on recruitment procedures in the companies over here, you have the 5 times same questions all over that are available also here and the newspapers and whatever in the magazines. But I think, Melissa, it is a certain mindset that has to be on the desk that the people realize, and that is, they say, okay, I want to work with Melissa.
Yeah, I mean, we only hire through referrals, and I only hire people I already know. And we hire, you know, experience is not important, or not as important as attitude. Attitude is the most important, because you're on your own. You have to be self-motivated, curious. You have to be someone who asks a lot of questions and look up answers on their own and be self-motivated, right? Like, and because the team is so small, if someone's not contributing, we know, like, immediately. You know, because you're in a startup, everybody does 10 things, not just this one thing, right? When you're a big company, there's 5 people doing the one thing, so maybe you can sit back and relax a bit, right? But if you're not contributing, we know immediately. And if you say you did this, but you didn't, I can check, right? So it's much harder to hide. But, you know, when we interview for attitude and really mission and vision alignment, I have the same conversation with them. Like, if I feel like they're a good fit, then I'll tell them the same story of how I became a bootstrapper and why I believe bootstrapping is important and why we are a company that puts happiness in front of revenue, like, and which also means that we want people to take time off. We don't have vacation policy. If you want to just take Friday off, you don't need to get permission. Just let people know that you're not going to be there, right? So we have like certain, not policy, but rules around that. It's just courtesy. And some people are very attracted to that. And so I think we, and a lot of, because we're so small, we're not hiring all the time. When we do need to hire, we usually go through our own network, or now that, you know, I'm posting multiple times on LinkedIn. So there's a lot of people on LinkedIn that ask me, you know, if I'm looking for help in certain areas, and if it's someone that I think can contribute, then I keep their name in top of mind. So, you know, we can revisit. But developers specifically, we only work through development shops. So we work with a dev shop in Vietnam, and then we work with a Vietnam that's based out of Norway, but they have an office in Ukraine. So they only hire Ukrainian developers, but treat them with kind of European benefits, which I think is pretty awesome. So the reason we do that is because developers specifically, I think, needs to work in a team. So in Vietnam, they do have an office where they go, and we work with, you know, we work with the team directly, but we also have a local kind of manager that helps us communicate things that we wouldn't be able to say maybe in their language, or, you know, in those cultures, people are not encouraged to express themselves or how they really feel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And so everything's always good, right? When you ask them, everything's always good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just culturally, we need to work with a middleman there. Mm-hmm. That gets how they actually feel.
Then
let us know if there's something, you know, we need to address.
The bootstrapping is a little bit slower than driven by venture capital, pumped up with a lot of cash. You can do a lot of things and you can scale the company. And everybody here is, if you are going here on startup festivals, everybody is asking you, how do you scale up? So your question how do you scale up? And when do you scale up? What do you answer these guys of people, this kind of people?
I mean, I would just say we scale up slowly and on our own terms. I think the idea of scaling is, I mean, I think the meaning of scaling is very wide, right? So I've heard a lot of people say, well, when you have your first 100 customers, you can start to scale, or when you hit 1 million, you can start to scale. You know, like when you have product market fit, you can start to scale. Well, even if somebody were to give me a lot of money right now, I wouldn't know where to put it because we have bigger problems than that. We are almost at 1.5 million ARR now. We're not nearly close to figuring out our product messaging. Like, we're not nailing our product messaging. People aren't coming to our website and getting what we're doing right away. We don't know how to find our ICP, but not because we don't know where they are. We don't know how to speak to them through the language that they understand. So there's all this testing we still have to do with, you know, our own site and our own content before we even begin to really scale the company, right? Like, we can't dump money into ads because all of that would be wasted. Like, what would the ad say, right? So I would say, like, when people are like, how are you going to scale? Well, I'm going to scale slowly because I want to control my company. But I'm not worried about that right now because we're already profitable. We're not paying ourselves market salaries yet, but we're close and we are profitable. So the whole stress of like needing to do everything or try everything is not there. We can be more conscious about what we do and doing it better and slow, but slower. But we're so far away, I think, from even figuring out like, how do we, you know, pour gas on the fire? I think the next thing we have to do is to try to figure out a repeatable user acquisition channel. And we do not have that today. But once we get there, then we can think about, okay, is it a money thing? Is it a person we have to hire? And I don't know what the answer is to that, but we do have, like, now that we have revenue, we also have a credit line with a company called CapChase that gives you credit lines based on MRR. So we have a pretty significant credit line that we can pull if we need to. And then of course there's, you know, cash in the company as well. So I'm not super worried about like, how do I scale? I'm more worried about how do I get to the point where we can scale. So we're still
great.
There.
Great, really great sentence. Great sentence at that point. Leads me to the last question I have for you, because it's really a pleasure to talk to you. What are your three ahas during your time as an entrepreneur? We had heard a lot of things, but pointed it out on three highlights during your life as an entrepreneur, as a bootstrapper. It is a great pleasure to have you here, but please, perhaps for our audience, you can point it out and share with us your insights. What are your lessons learned?
Interesting. Very short time to go through my last 13 years, but let me think. I think one of the biggest learnings, I guess that wasn't that early on. It was maybe like 5 years in my 5 years into my entrepreneur journey. I've been in it for 13 years, but it was early in my last startup. I had mentioned I struggled for 2.5 years to find that product. And at one point, the product was very bleeding edge. And what that meant was we had, do you remember what a beacon was? Like a hardware, like it was like a Bluetooth device, or, you know, it was like a near field device. Like when it was like hardware where you can put into a room. And then if you have the app, like say you're in a mall, and when you walk into a mall, you get a coupon and on your app. It never took off, right? But at one point our product was going to be an open house beacon solution where real estate agents would have a hardware beacon. They would put it in the house and you would go look at houses and you walk in the house and it would ping you, you know, all of these details about the house. And at that time, beacons were like the new thing. Like it was going to be like the next biggest technology. It was like the AI of that time. And because we were a beacon solution, everyone wrote about it. All the media wrote about it. And I But at the same time, I couldn't get people to use it because they didn't understand it. Like, it was so far away from what they knew, right? So, but because people kept writing about it, I thought we were onto something. So my biggest aha moment was, you can't confuse media validation with market validation. The media is driven by really cool, nifty things that people click on. But market will adopt something they understand. And sometimes those things are just so far apart. They're very, very different things. And it's because I confuse media validation that I kept trying and then wasting all that money to do this thing and then trying to find beta customers. So I think that was my first thing. The second aha moment that I think is worth talking about is, it's like to create something that is beautifully simple is not the same as creating something that's simply beautiful. To create something that's beautifully simple is the iPhone, right? It's kind of like the Steve Jobs philosophy, right? But it takes a lot more effort to write a short letter. But that's what people need to adopt a product. You can't just slap everything on. It can't have all these features. It needs to be super simple, especially to start. And it just does one thing and one thing super well. The moment you are, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep, you're nothing to anyone because you're trying to be everything to everyone. And I experienced that myself in my last company, when we had this open house product and we had the beacon and the app and then, it had the real estate agent side and then the home buyer side and then it had all these features, but nobody was using it. We were building all these features, but nobody was using it. And, you know, and I thought, well, maybe if we build this other feature, then they would start using it. Right? But people don't understand, like, the more stuff we added, the less they understood. And actually the product that they ended up paying for was when we stripped 90% of features. We took 90% away and then they started using it. We only left in the sign-in form. That was it. There was no beacon, none of those cool features, just the form on the iPad. And then the first person paid us $10. So that was when I really understood, like, you can never underestimate the power of simplicity. And I guess the last one would be, like, the best way to validate a business or a product is to know that something else like it exists in the world. Like, when people are like, oh, I'm going to do this thing, no one's doing it, I see that as a red flag. Because in my last company, I was trying to do this thing that no one's ever seen before. And I thought, because no one's seen before, they must want me because I'm the only one. But it's because I'm the only one that they question why it exists at all. Right. If you come up with a CRM right now, no one's going to question, hey, why do you have a CRM? Like, they know what it's for. So, like, that whole education cycle to convince someone to buy this brand new thing that they've never seen before, they've never budgeted for, is actually much harder than selling them something that, you know, they can compare on the marketplace. So maybe they want to buy this Apple and then they're like, yeah, this, your Apple kind of looks good, but let me go to the grocery store and compare to the other Apples, right? And it's just a much easier sell. And that's what we did with eWebinar that we did not do with my last company. So I think those would be my three biggest aha moments.
Okay. Yeah. One thing that came in my, is now coming in my mind. We didn't talk about OpenAI and ChatGPT. Yeah. We didn't talk about that, but just one more last question, because it's now very important. It's actual in all, everything festival is, they are talking about ChatGPT, not talking about the procedures and the worries about the war weekend with the Altman guy and the CFO. That is not the topic. Do you think that KI is getting into the companies very quick as an idea to use it for any support or whatever, also in your company?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's trying to integrate it in some way. I'm not. You know, we have some talks about it internally, but I don't think we're too far away from using, like, what we want AI to do in our product. It can't be achieved today but I don't think we're too far away from it, right? Like, the best thing would be you upload a video and I say, write all my reminders and follow-up emails in this way and, you know, create all the polls, all the questions. Done. Write my landing page. It's not possible today, but that would be incredible. If I upload a video, upload the transcript so the AI knows what my webinar is about and it just writes everything for me. That would be amazing. A lot of people that are saying, oh, AI is doing this, AI is doing this. You can use AI for your customer success, for your support. They're not even thinking because an AI can answer super basic support questions. That's already in your knowledge base, right? Like Intercom is like, it wasn't AI before. I think they're building something now, but they have something similar where it's like, oh, do you mean this thing or this thing? And then they point you to the right knowledge base. And you know, like 70% of the time they're right. But it can't answer questions like, I installed this widget on my landing page, but it's not working. Can you check it? Right? My tracking pixel is not firing. Can you check it? Those are the questions that we need help with. And that needs a developer to go in and say, did they, you know, edit the code? Or maybe it's a WordPress page and they have a special plugin and that's why it doesn't work. I think there are certain things that it can do in customer success. I think people are being super optimistic about it right now because it's new and exciting. But at least for us, it's not going to solve the problems we actually need it to solve.
It was a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for having you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.